Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. In this episode, we're going to talk about what makes a great TV dad and a whole lot more. Let's get on with the show. My name's Aaron Peterson. Joining me today, I'm my fellow host, John Davenport.
Hey, buddy.
Troy Heinrichs.
I'm back, bitches.
And Amanda Sink is not. She's done. Gone. Already. So fast.
We're like a bad penny. Sometimes I turn up, sometimes she turns up.
One thing that's important, and I think people should know this, is right now there is a Gilgo Beach killer true crime hosted by 50 Cent on Peacock. And I think it's important to point that out. I think everybody should give it a shot because when I think of true crime, I think 50 Cent. Everybody wants to do true crime now, man. Everybody. It's a very popular genre.
I'm pretty sure there's a couple of people here who do true crime.
Yeah, but we're not 50 Cent.
It's a I'll true say that. Crime, but that's a show. That's what that is.
Yeah, that's something you got to watch. Like, just the, that's the sales pitch right there. 50 Cent, true crime. I want to see this. And if you didn't know, Warner Brothers is splitting up their divisions now. Did you hear about that?
What?
Yeah. They're
what?
They can't stop. They can't stop messing with it. So Warner Brothers Discovery, this is reported by Variety earlier in the week. Warner Brothers Discovery CEO David Zaslav will remain as the leader of the streaming-focused entity, while Gunnar Wiedenfels, the company's CFO, who's become known for finding new ways to cut old costs, will lead the TV company. So the separation is expected to be done in mid-2026, and they're going to be two completely separate entities. So you're going to get the studio and streaming side, and then you're going to get the TV network side. So HBO Max, I believe, will be with Zaslav still.
That's weird to me. Like, wouldn't you want your TV stuff to be on the streaming? So the studio would be one company, and the TV streaming would be the
streaming
company?
Company will encompass the Warner TV and movie studios, HBO and HBO Max, and a games and experiences division. So
it's weird.
Hey, man, I didn't write it. Just telling you what's up. I just want to know why HBO can't get... Why they can't just stick to whatever our strategy is? Why is there a new strategy every couple months?
This is what's called floundering. You know, when somebody who was a top dog for so long realizes, oh shit, we screwed up. Now they're just scrambling for whatever it is they can come up with as a way to save themselves from like the whole total screw up they did.
Feels fair.
And yet it was back in the days when AT&T owned it, when the network was actually decent.
It's wild.
Explain that one. It's wild.
And of course, you know, AT&T. That's why Amanda can't be here, because she's got AT&T. It's all connected. I blame Zaslav for that, too. Why not?
That Zaslav.
All right. Well, here's some cool news. So Goonies hit 40 this past week. Cocoon hits 40 this week, when you're listening to this. And Back to the Future in 2 weeks. I just want to know if it's making anybody feel a little... And Jaws is going to be 50 next week, which is going to be a big focus of our podcast next week. Because we're going to... That's a monumental anniversary. But I just want to say, like, do you feel old? Do you feel like you're getting a little old?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I'm 39, so.
Shut up.
You know, I don't want to focus on the idea of whether or not these movies are getting old. I think I prefer to look at it as I'm like these movies in the sense that I just keep getting better with age.
Well played.
Is it?
I think that... Well, I think the movies are great because they're timeless. Like, you could show these to anybody, except for people. We actually did a thing on this. There's actually a generational gap between, I think it's like 39 to 35. There's like a group of people that do not, like, absolutely dislike the Goonies.
I don't get that. How do you dislike the Goonies?
Because for that group of people, it was like a study that was done. It was like that group of people did not have the same type of, like, after school, hang out with your friends, get on your bike, go through town like we all did in the 80s and early 90s. There's like that group of people, like late 90s, early 2000s, that didn't have that experience. So the concept of going on a treasure hunt and hanging out with your friends and playing kick the can and all those fun games that we used to play back in the day, like, that stuff doesn't compute in their brain. So therefore, they don't connect to the movie as well as like we did.
Yeah, I mean, growing up for me, every day was an absolute adventure where the kids who were growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, not a clue what that was like. it wasn't as bad in the 90s as it was the early 2000s, but it just keeps getting progressively worse, where or worse for kids, where we are being more and more protective over what happens to the kids because of our exposure to the nightmares that we all basically have and how easy it is. Next door neighbor could be a problem. So it's sad. It breaks my heart. It's not even like a generational issue in the sense of just like, you know, in the States. It's happening worldwide, where there's kids that aren't living the same sort of life that we used to live and live the same sort of adventures we used to have.
Well, they're having new adventures and they're doing different things. And that's, I mean, every generation feels that their generation got it right. So that's not unusual. I just think these movies are definitely a time capsule for a time when people, when kids would go out in groups together and get into a little bit of trouble and, you know, have a little fun. A Cocoon was kind of like the version of that where they wish they could go back and do it again, right? Like they missed those opportunities. So those movies are kind of, you know, flip sides of each other if you really think about it.
Well, Aaron, like you said it once before on the show that you were a latchkey kid growing up. And the concept of a latchkey kid has been nearly alien since at least the mid-90s.
But you know how many people have told me when I was raising my kids, and I would be fine with them going off and doing their own things when they were 10, 11 years old. And people would say, that's terrible. And I'm like, well, I was doing that when I was like 7 or something. Well, that's child abuse. Shut up. No, maybe in your house, not mine. I was responsible-ish. My mom could trust me to get home before the streetlights came on and all that other stuff. That's the way it normally was back in the 80s. Yeah. And, you know, and I'm not saying, I actually think, you know, John, you and I know this from doing all that the true crime shows. I think it was worse back then. I just think that
it was way easier to do horrible
things back then. They didn't have all the technology in one. It's just we weren't as aware of it. It wasn't as in our face and it wasn't as prominent in our media and our social media algorithms and all that other stuff. So kids could just go out and be kids. And yeah, we might have, you know, got into some trouble or something bad happened occasionally, but I think it happens roughly at the same amount per capita than it did now versus then. Probably less now, I would say, because crime has gone way down.
Mathematically speaking, yes, crime is way down for a lot of different reasons that you'd be surprised to hear. But yeah, it's way different now.
Mm-hmm.
And then you talk to your 20 to 30 year olds, which are like most of our kids that are now
Gen Z, Gen Z and millennials.
A little maybe Gen Z below, Gen Alpha, maybe that those people are like, they love the Goonies because like, oh my, I watched with my dad and I watched, you know, like we're having those experiences. Like my kid right now is just like, I don't know where the hell he is. I have his location services. I could check to figure out where he is, but I don't need to go check because I know that he's out playing pickleball, going to the club, going to the gym, climbing with his friends, going to pick up Raising Cane's for food. Like he's self-sufficient. Like I don't have to worry about him.
Find a better chicken place. I'm just letting you know.
Hey, it's his choice.
If you're listening, young man, I'm not going to say his name on the podcast. Find a better chicken place because you know what I mean?
What chicken place is he going to?
Raising Cane. There's no flavor in those chicken strips, man. None. It's all in the sauce.
It's all in the sauce.
Dave's Hot Chicken. I'm going to give you a free product placement, Dave's Hot Chicken. I love Dave's Hot Chicken. Love it.
How you're going to take this or not, Troy, but that kid can't handle flavor. You look at that kid and there's no flavor happening on him.
Get him some Dave's Hot Chicken. That is good stuff.
He doesn't like the way I season the chicken, so apparently he's probably true.
How do you feel about, when you talk about Goonies and Cocoon, and I think Cocoon is a grossly underrated movie.
It's a great movie.
The Gutenberg, so man. That's back in his high point. I love the Gutenberg back in the
80s. Oh, man. Did you see that when the fires were happening, him going out and saving people from the fires?
Steven Gutenberg, he's still a hero.
Man.
He's a hero.
He's still great. He's out saving firemen.
Wilford Brimley, who famously, you know, is the same age as Paul Rudd or whatever in that movie. And it's, he's always looked like a 75-year-old man. Just born that way. Just born like he looked like Colonel Sanders or whatever. Crazy
man, different times, man. Different times.
Hey, no, people didn't live as long, you know, we worse habits, everybody was eating lead. I don't know, it was bad time. But Back to the Future, that one hitting 40 is a huge deal because we've had so much, we already have a lot like attached to that movie. I think, you know, Michael J. Fox and his whole kind of bringing awareness to Parkinson's as a whole, I mean, because of his popularity and whatnot. It's a movie that I think is a rare occasion where it's a perfect movie. I can't think of anything wrong with it. Like Goonies, I could maybe here or there, I guess. I have nothing but good memories of it. Cocoon, I can pick apart. Back to the Future, the first one is a perfect movie, even 40 years later. It's like Jaws in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree? I mean, Troy, that's one of your favorite movies, right?
I mean, so. I still quote it to this day. We pulled it out. I mean, that should have been like the whole, instead of pulling out Paul Rudd for the Nintendo Switch 2 commercial, kind of recreating that Super Nintendo option that they had mm-hmm. when they were doing the marketing, they should have, anytime I see Mario Kart World, the new Mario Kart that came out for Switch 2, all I just keep thinking in my head is like, roads, where we're going, we don't need roads because they don't drive on the road in that game. They're flying, they're jumping, they're going on the rails, they're going all over the place. It's like the perfect tagline for that.
Do you ever
people
wonder,
my age that can afford $450 to buy a gaming system?
Do you ever wonder, and no. Please don't read into this, right? What if Marty, what if he did it? You know what I mean? Like, what would they have done? How does that work with the time space?
Are you implying what I think you're implying right now?
Just like, theoretically, you know, we're dealing with fictional universe. I mean, what if he slipped? You know, and just said, all right. You know what I mean? What would have happened? I mean, other than getting its own category on Pornhub, what would have happened? The time-space comedian, would he have lost his whole family? Where would he have started a whole new one? They all would have looked the same, kind of.
I feel like he would have disappeared before he finished. Or as he finished.
God, it's horrible.
That's a hell of a ghosting.
I don't know why I bother asking these questions. Oh man, how do you feel about the sequels? Are we fans of these? I like the third one. I didn't like the second one at all.
Yeah, we didn't need them, but the third one's a lot of fun. You know, it's a different take, different concept. They introduce because they introduce the chicken part, call him Yeller and all that other mm-hmm. fun. Like
it Clint gave Eastwood. Some character. He's Clint
yeah, gave some character yeah. depth to it, which I thought was nice.
Well. Yeah, they made it so that like the whole chicken thing was like something in his DNA by doing that. You know, that's the thing that was interesting. It was like it had to be something that bothered his ancestors so badly that it was in his DNA at that point by the time it got to Marty, which is an interesting concept as far as like for psychology is concerned. The second one is kind of like the Empire Strikes Back. If it was Empire Strikes Back was a bad movie of the trilogy.
It was like the opposite of Empire Strikes Back.
No, I'm saying, well, it doesn't, like, to me, it doesn't feel like a happy-go-lucky fun movie at all. It's kind of like dire and scary and a little bit problematic and just doesn't feel good. Which Empire Strikes Back is all those things, but a good movie.
I can get what they're trying to do, though, because at the, you know, at the end of the first movie, right, the bad guy is beaten, right, standard trope, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in order to make a second movie, we got to say, well, what can we do with the bad guy? You know, like that was the pitch, I'm sure, for the second movie was, what do we do with the bad guy now?
How do we get Biff in here?
Right.
Yeah. Well, because they're doing what, you know, we would have done if we had a time machine, is get the Sports Almanac and start buying Apple stock.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have rigged the system. Absolutely. Give me a time machine. I'll go back and buy an Apple stock and put it in my kid's name. My kid
will go back. Imagine how rich you would have been on the GameStop poll. If you knew about the GameStop pull ahead of time,
getting Bitcoin when it's like $100.
Oh, just imagine. Wish I had a time machine. You know what I wouldn't do? Visit my mom, because it's just creepy.
That's just weird.
But I will say, here's one other thing. This tells you how different the 80s were. Number one, you can have a storyline where a kid goes back in time and has to avoid having sex with his mother, and it still ends up being a classic film, right? And you can also have a movie about a bunch of kids going on a treasure hunt and the pirate's named One-Eyed Willie and nobody bats a fucking eye about it. That's all I got to say.
Never made the connection until just now.
Just saying.
I was at the same way with Princess Bride the other day when someone was like, really? Prince Humperdink? And I was like,
it's not as direct, but I can ride with it. Sure.
It was like, okay. Totally missed the boat on that one when I was younger.
It's gonna change your viewing of Goonies later, John. Just so you know.
It will.
Mm-hmm. It's gonna really mess me up now.
All right, let's go to our.
Kind of wish that octopus scene was in there now.
Oh, God. Let's go to our From the Outside In topic. What makes a great TV dad? And you know, we've We haven't talked about movie or TV dads in over a decade, just so you know, on this podcast.
Has it really been a decade?
It's been over a decade that we've even mentioned them. And we've never really talked about what makes a great one. We just kind of talked about our favorite ones way back when, which might have even changed. You know, I'm sure somebody's going to say, Walter White, that's my favorite, which is messed up.
It's a horrible dad.
That's a messed up answer.
Hey, he came back.
When?
Came back a year later or whatever. My question is, there's thousands of TV dads out there over the years. And I think some people would automatically go back to the old industry standards, right? They go to the Happy Days. They go to Beaver Cleaver's dad, you know. They go back in time, Andy Griffith, things like that, as like the stereotypical great dads. And I don't agree with them. I don't anymore. I think, no. I don't know what I said 10 years ago, but I don't agree with that now. So what makes a great one? Both in like how they handle issues and to ways that they influenced you potentially. Like what would you say? What makes a great TV dad when you watch a show?
You know, for me, it's a couple of different things. You know, do they have a good fatherly presence on the show?
What's a fatherly presence?
I don't know, somebody who stands in front of you and they have command over a room. They have command over the people around them in a way that shows also emotional intelligence. Are they supportive? Do they have a sense of humor? Are they flawed? Like, all these things are things that I look for in a great TV dad. They better be flawed in some sort of way, because I don't want to see a dad on the screen that's perfect, because that's just unrealistic.
What's flawed? Like, beats his children?
You know,
cracks the whip, drinks a little bit, cocaine.
Makes drugs in his camper.
Actually, now that you mention it, cocaine is probably not a bad one.
dad's doing lines over there, just waiting. I'm going to discipline you in a minute.
Yeah, somebody who's fatherly in the sense of they're able to not only be that person that leads the room or leads a family and makes room for everybody else, but also is able to see their own flaws and try to improve their own flaws in the people around them, you know?
Maybe not in the around them, but in themselves, right? They're continuing to grow, right? So they're teaching their children how to grow. They're leading the house and teaching the house how to grow while they're still trying to grow themselves, because they're not perfect, right? When you have the perfect dad, like, you know, Mr. Cleaver or any of those from the 50s and 60s, it's like
the infallible ones, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like it was all propaganda marketing back in the day, because that's what you thought conservatism should have been, right? This is what the traditional family should look like. And we get very clearly, you know, as we move on to, you know, more of the early 2000s and 2010s, you know, the dynamic of what is the perfect family or what is the standard of the family, all of that has changed drastically. So really what you're looking for is just what makes a good man, and that really not even a good man, but a good person who wants to play that role of leader, we'll call it, right? Because you could have two moms, you could have two dads, you could have, you know,
I used to watch that show all the time. My Two Dads. Yeah,
My Two Dads was great. Yeah. So it's just, who is that person that says, I have you, no matter what, whether you screw up, whether you do something awesome, whether you need a good beat down, like all of those, like, no matter what, I got you. You're going to be safe. You're going to be good. You're going to be fine. We're going to get through this. Like, the people that can give you that kind of care and warmth and understanding, even when it's a discipline situation, you know, those are the people that you want to get behind, because hopefully you can be like them someday.
Yeah, we've mentioned a couple times that the fathers from the 50s and 60s were idealized in a certain way, almost to be like propaganda as far as what people expected. But there's one father from the 50s and 60s that kind of broke the mold, and they did so on purpose as a satire, but they didn't realize they were creating the footprint for a modern father, which was Gomez Adams. Because he was somebody who, like, he's supposed to be a freak, right? He's supposed to be this weird monster of a character that is a little bit crazy and a little bit weird, but he was always wildly supportive of his kids, let them be as weird as they wanted to be, pushed them to greater levels of being themselves, and he adored his wife. These were all things that were supposed to be satirical in the sense of, like, you know, this, in the sense of, like, they were making fun of they wanted somebody to be completely opposite of what everyone saw a father figure being like, and that's what they created, is the footprint for the modern father.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that, I suppose. I think I used to be drawn more to the people that were a little bit more fun, I guess. I mean, Uncle Jesse and Dukes of Hazzard, I would consider a father figure. And I kind of grew up, I grew up without a dad. So I was very drawn to dads that were probably flawed, like you talked about being flawed, but also were very dedicated. I don't know if you remember a show called The Courtship of Eddie's Father. I don't know if you guys remember that one.
I remember it. I never watched it.
Bill Bixby, you know, he eventually became Incredible Hulk, but you know, he was just like a widower who raises his kid, and he was just like a very devout father. And I remember being very impressed with him because he was so devoted to his kid, and I didn't understand that at the time, that sort of thing. And then as you get older, like you raise your kids and you kind of see what a dad should be. So what I would do was I would gravitate on TV. I would want to see dads that weren't like me, they like represented kind of the things that I didn't represent, because kind of hoping I don't know, maybe that I would pull a little from them. Like maybe they had qualities that I could empathize with or that I could utilize in my own parenting and kind of grow as a parent. Cause I think parents should always grow. Like Troy, was it you that we were talking about evolving? And TV, I think that's extremely important, because as a dad, I think that's the most important thing. Like as you get older and you do it for a while, you have to change how you do things, because nobody starts knowing what to do, right? It's an evolution, and you're going to make tons of mistakes. Like that's why I don't like perfect dads in TV shows. They just drive me nuts, because no dad has it figured out from, or mom, from the beginning. They just don't. You just figure out, you know, you have a moral code. You have to have some kind of moral code. And you have to stick to whatever that moral code is. And then you kind of adjust as you go how to apply that moral code in your skills and your parenting skills, just like anything else. So any character that doesn't evolve, I have a really hard time connecting with. And I think where I have been most impressed is like seeing dads where now that my kids are grown, like when because I've been most impressed with Phil Dunphy on Modern Family, right? Like that's the one.
Yeah, he's a great dad.
Really impressed me the most. And it's because I wish I would have from the get-go been that kind of dad, you know? But, you know, I started super young, so I have to grow into the kind of dad I want to be and da-da-da-da. And also, you know, every family situation is different, especially when you come from a fractured family, right? Like Troy, you're still married to your spouse, so you guys can kind of work in unison. I was not, so I never got to work in unison. Like it was always kind of a lot of back and forth, and I wish I could have had more Phil in me. So when I watch that show, it's a lot of adoration and almost emulation. Like I wish I could emulate that, because he handles things so well. Like he's always supportive, but never ignoring their missives. Like he can see something as a strength, even if his wife Claire doesn't see it, and they can work to come together and figure out the best way to deal with certain things. And you know, I think those are the elements that become most important as they grow. And he also evolves as he goes on. Like he learns from his kids and his kids learn from him. And I think that's an important aspect of being a TV dad too, or a dad in general, just in general.
Well, and that's because he believes that everybody, not just his kids, but like everybody is like inherently good. Right.
Yeah.
And I think
he gives him the benefit of the doubt.
It gives him the starting point to be like, my kids are awesome. Right. They're good. No matter what they're doing, they're good. Yeah. And then he's got to be like, yeah, maybe we don't want to do that, but you do you. It's okay. And then of course, when stuff hits the fan, he's still there. So I think, you know, the antics that he does, the jokes that he does, the trying to be funny and relate. Yeah. I think that just shows like, he's just trying to connect because he wants to be there, you know, versus the dads that are just like, I really didn't want a kid, but now I got to work. And so I just can throw myself into work and go to the bar and drink and stay away from the house as much as possible. Like you don't see those dads portrayed as much on TV.
Yeah, and I think I like, especially as I'm older now, I really like that representation of a dad, just because, you know, then you go and you look at like, what is it, Dan Connor, is that Roseanne, John Goodman's character on Roseanne?
Yeah.
You know, I used to think, well, what a great dad. But then you grow older and you're like, God, he's just so sarcastic. And is that the best thing for those kids? And like, you know, he is a good dad and he takes care of things. So in a way, he really handles, you know, the family as in the way that, you know, that whole machismo thing that I think people associate with being a dad. But then I go and I watch something like Modern Family and I'm like, I think that's really the kind of dad most people would need. Like that's better. Like this overly masculine, which I tended to parent in that way, which was it's time to bust some heads, you know, whether it be my kids or anyone that hurts them, you know, that maybe that's not the best way. Maybe that's an old viewpoint on what parenting should be.
I think it depends on when the TV show takes place too. Because sure. Look at
times change.
The latest dad of awesomeness, Mr. Jack Pearson from This Is Us, right? Like in that show, he goes from being there for his wife, right, and then he has to deal with his dad and his baggage from his dad being a drunk. So he has to battle his own alcoholism. He's got to battle the loss of one of his kids, like on the day that they're born, and then he's trying to start a new company. And just he's trying to survive, and he's got triplets basically. And so like the love and care that he shows his wife, the love and care that he shows his kids, even though he's this hard ass because he's literally got to fight every day to make ends meet. It just shows like there's flaws in people. And sometimes the things that they say and do and snap and lose control from time to time aren't because they're a bad person. It's just because they're overwhelmed. And it's what you do in the overwhelm moment to save that. That really is what showcases whether you're a good dad or not. When you say, yeah, I screwed up. I'm sorry. I should have been better.
Where's Mr. Spencer rate from Psych?
He kind of walks the line in a weird way, doesn't he?
Yeah. Do you think he's a good dad in Psych?
I think when he's younger, he's a terrible dad.
Like Henry Spencer as a dad. Now, genuine question. Why do you think that? Because I do think like when they do the flashbacks, he's always trying to teach him a life lesson, even if he's a little bit of a hard ass. But, and this is, I probably understand him more than I should.
Yeah.
But when you have like a kid who's constantly getting in trouble and you're trying to raise them, sometimes you feel like you have to be the hard ass to get across. So, I mean, I kind of get where he's coming from. I don't think he's an awful dad, but tell me why you think he is.
I just think he's a tough dad to deal with when he's younger, as he's raising Sean. Like a perfect example of like
Psych is a great show if you've never watched. It's on Peacock.
Fantastic show. I was actually just had it on for shits and giggles over the weekend. But there's an episode where Sean is running away from a bully that's been picking on him, and why he was running away from the bully was because he threw the rock at the bully and he's trying to get away. So Henry gets him to go out and speak to the bully and find common ground in which that, like, this is actually a really great lesson. Go out there, talk to the bully, find something that you guys agree on, and then work it out. So he goes out there and he's like, oh, hey, you're having trouble with math, right? And the guy is the bully is like, yeah. And he tells him, well, if you answer every third question with C, you'll pass the test, and that way you're not going to have any sort of problems with math anymore, because our teacher has a system and that's every third answer is always C. So the book, like, all that's doing great and everything's fantastic. He learned this whole great lesson about how to like, come to a common ground with somebody he has a disagreement with. But then because Henry heard him do this, immediately calls the teacher to be like, you gotta fix your test because my kid has figured his stuff out.
I get it though. I'm with him. I'm still on Henry's side on that one.
I mean, on the one side, I'm on his side, but on the other side,
kids gotta learn. Kids gotta leave no child behind. It's ruined children.
The bully is just gonna be mad at him again.
He is, but he's gonna learn a lesson to find a better way to get common ground. Bottom line is, we can't just let kids, pass classes. Like they gotta learn, man. They gotta be held accountable. You know what I mean?
I get it.
I get where Henry Spencer's coming.
Yeah.
That's why it's the same reason why the TSA is saying your Costco card don't count as a real ID, because our education system has failed, and therefore Henry Spencer is trying to save it one child at a time.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to show like 4 forms of ID in order to get a Costco card. So, I mean, it's been validated.
Stop.
But as an adult, Henry Spencer is a much better father because he's much different in his approach and he
evolves.
He's evolved into a different person, and it works out to be so much better. So it's great because it makes him a great dad because he did learn from a lot of his lessons and a lot of his loss. At the same time, when he's a younger dad, I don't think he's that great.
I can relate to him, and probably because I parented more like that than I did anything else.
Well, you had to, a single dad. Henry was, it's tough.
It's very tough. Yeah.
You know, the thing that the show does very well, that as someone who recently lived with his father for a year and a half, right? It does this great thing that people don't realize, that at some point in your life, you start looking at your parents and you're like, oh my God, they're just a funhouse mirror of me.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what that was happening on the show. That's one of the reasons why Sean and Henry kind of butt heads the way they are, because Sean is just looking at his dad going, I see myself and everything that he's doing, and only a little bit different, and it's making me crazy. And
which is funny, because Sean is very ridiculous in a lot of his ways, when his dad's very serious. But yeah, I can see what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the point is there. But that funhouse mirror, that he's reflection doing,
he's
is
trying
still
to
there.
Do everything he can to not become his father.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so it's a beautiful thing. When I know, as someone who I mean, I don't have kids, but I am a kid to an elder gentleman, elder statesman. And anytime I'm around him, I sit there and I watch it. I'm like, oh shit, that's me. All right, that's me too. That's, oh God, I hate that in me. You know, and that's something that I think all of us go through.
I don't. My dad wasn't around until I was 17. So, but he's been around ever since. But it is funny when people are like, well, you act just like your dad. I'm like, I do not. I promise you, I do not. No. I act just like my mother.
Your dad might act like you.
That's very possible. Yeah, that's very possible. What about TV shows? Do you think they do enough to show when moms have to be dads and vice versa? I mean, you know, there are a lot of, especially as someone who is a single dad and did a lot of the raising themselves. It's always funny to me how they aren't positioned in that respect on TV. You know what I mean?
Like single moms?
And single dad, like single parents that have to fill both roles.
I don't know. I feel like that cheapens the role that the person's taking by sitting there and trying to say, well, this mom is now has to be the dad, and this dad now has to be the mom at the same time. Like, I think that cheapens.
But it's a fact. I mean, when you're raising kids, it is. I mean,
it may be a fact, right? But I think it cheapens the Herculean feat that the person's going through just to do the job anyways. You know, I think that's where I come from. I don't want to sit there and like try to be like, well, the mom's be trying to be a dad too, because I mean, I think that's a shitty way to be like a shitty way to say that.
They should have similar roles.
I think it just takes away from the person who's doing it by themselves, but sit there and be like, I have to be the mom and the dad. And it's like, no, you just have to be the parent. Just kick some ass and like, and unfortunately you're in a position where you have to do it more than anybody else does. And you don't have backup or, you know, sort of control. And I think you should wear that as a red badge of courage and be proud of the fact that you're doing a good job of it. Again, not a parent. I'm not qualified to say any of those words, but still that's my thoughts on it.
Yeah. I was trying to think like shows that wouldn't have the dad, but the dad's kind of around though too. So it's not like they're like truly like playing the role of dad in that regard, but like, cause like, I think the dad pops up a couple times on Gilmore Girls, right? Stranger Things, you know, you have...
Stranger Things is the worst dad on television.
You think so?
He is the worst dad. Not
including Rick Grimes?
No, not including Rick Grimes. And not Hopper. I'm not talking about Hopper. I'm talking about Mike's dad, who has no idea what's going on at any given time. Mr. Wheeler is the most useless dad on television.
Very fair.
That is fair. Yeah, that is fair. His wife's almost banging the lifeguard.
Pool boy who's in high school.
Yep. Oh, boy. There's a lot of bad TV dads out there. Not as many as you would like, but there's some really good. There's some like great role models too. Uncle Phil is a prime example. What a great fill-in dad.
He's fantastic.
The scene, like that show, like truly shows the difference between like nature versus nurture, and that like you choose family, like family chooses you. You're not ingrained into the family that you're like biologically tied to.
Sure.
Because that scene when Will's dad walks out on him, and then Uncle Phil just embraces him. Like, oh my, like,
did it break your heart?
Because you're just like, Phil's just like yelling at everybody all the time. You know, he's like the angry guy, you know, oh my God, Will, oh my God, why? Like, and then he does that move and it's just like, oh, I get it.
Yeah. I mean, he was stern, loving, morally grounded. That's an important thing. He was morally grounded and emotionally available when it counted. And that's what made him such a great TV dad.
Red Foreman. Calling his kid dumbass every 15 seconds. I don't know if that's good or not, but he was a good dad otherwise.
His technique wasn't as good, but I think overall he was a good dad.
He was a good dad.
Yeah.
Malcolm in the Middle's dad, Bryan Cranston, before he did that.
Oh my God.
There's a lot of great dads out there.
Before he became the worst dad on TV.
Bob Belcher. He's another great dad. He's the kind of dad that Who? Like he's Bob Belcher from Bob's Burgers.
I've never seen it. I couldn't tell.
Okay. So he allows his kids to be as weird as they want to be. He's supportive. He's weird himself in his own way. And he loves his wife. So it makes them all great at dad's material.
But the two I look up to, like modern TV, I think would be Sandy Cohen from The OC.
Really?
Yeah, because he was, he's like the guy who's like, I think he was a lawyer or he's working with like underappreciated kids or what have you. And he was just trying to like make sure kids had homes and whatnot. And he finds, you know, Ryan and brings him into his family. But he was good, able to balance, you know, how he treated Ryan versus how he treated Seth, right? So like balancing out those two kids while still trying to like appease his wife to say like, no, it's okay that we totally brought in a rebel without a cause into this multi-million-dollar home in the hills. It's like, so like his, he had really good, what do you call it? Like relationship advice, really good conversation skills. I mean, he really cared about the kids at the end of the day. And I thought that was always fun. Even though you were totally watching his eyebrows the entire time. Cause Jesus.
And who's the other one?
Eric Taylor, Coach Taylor.
Friday Night Lights. I figured that would be happening.
Yeah. Like Coach Taylor is just, he's got a whole hot mess of stuff going on, right? He's trying to keep this new job on the school where they're like state or bust. His quarterback goes out in the first, you know, episode and whatnot. And now he's got to deal with all that. And then come to the end of the first season where he basically gets offered his dream job when he finds out that his wife's pregnant. And like, what do you do with that? Right. So then you deal with that whole like long distance relationship and how does he make a marriage work while he's doing a new job? And then as it evolves over the course of the series, you get towards the end and he gets another opportunity like that, but he actually lets his wife go for her career and he takes the back seat. And I was like, man, that's like, that's admirable. You know, like you had your time in the sun. It's time for your wife to shine.
Fair enough. Yeah.
And he's a dad to all the players, of course, that he coaches over the course of the year, Smash and Street and the whole plethora of the gang, Saracen, Seven.
So have you taken any life lessons away from TV dads over the years? I will tell you, this. I learned to always be cunning because Tywin Lannister really taught me that. Like always be thinking about your family dynasty and map it all out and how you're going to make sure everybody stays safe and smart. I like that. Yeah. That's an important life lesson. That's the only good lesson that came from Tywin Lannister, but still, there. That's one.
I would say I learned lessons, but I know I did this.
Oh boy.
Which was when my parents like would give me advice that I didn't like, I watched Growing Pains and I watched Mr. Seaver. And Mr. Seaver would give like the same kind of advice as my parents, and I'd be like, okay, fine, sure, yep, I got your mom and dad. Mr. Seaver said so. Or Mr. Seaver would give advice that I would like more lean to my side of the story. But he's like, but you also have to know like when to push and when to hold. And like, I always thought Mr. Seaver was really good on that parenting advice side. Like you'd always go get like a checks and balances kind of thing. It's almost like the therapist dad,
sure,
if you will.
I like Terry Stone's.
Which I think he was a therapist in the show, if I remember correctly.
I like Terry Stone's dad because he'd always, no matter what crazy thing he did, he'd always be like, and I'm feeling much better now.
Yeah. for me, I already buried the lead on this one, but it's Gomez Adams, which he taught me that unconditional love means never making the people around you feel like they have to change to feel like they're accepted. And you know, and that's what was always great about Gomez Adams. He showed that passion, weirdness, and loyalty are all strengths, not flaws.
Do you like that they finally have like a comic appropriate look for him in Wednesday?
Yeah.
Do you?
I dig it. Yeah. I've liked every version of Gomez Adams, but I do like the comic appropriate version of him too. And then Herman Munster, oddly enough, is another one.
Fred Gwynne, man. Fred Gwynne was a great dad. Yeah.
You know, and he taught me that kindness, vulnerability are not weaknesses, and you know, they're superpowers. And even when he's a mess, he owns his own heart and humility, which like those are all things that as an adult that I like for both of them that I try to live, and I think I do a fairly good job at it.
Well, I grew up watching with my grandfather Andy Griffith's show. So Andy Taylor is really probably, even though he's a little too perfect, but he wasn't perfect. He wasn't like the Beaver's dad. You know, he would make mistakes and he would be a little too stern and he would have to come and teach Opie a lesson and also own up to being a little too harsh in certain elements. And again, I also like Uncle Jesse on Dukes of Hazzard, even though the car has become problematic over the years. Because you sure didn't understand it when it was on. I wish I would have understood it when I was a kid. Like, wait, that means what? You know, I didn't understand it back in the day. And so I've had quite a few over the years, but I really did like Harry Stone's dad a lot. It's weird, but I did, even though he was very estranged and he didn't really know him very well, but I always liked him.
Another one that I think that we kind of forget about is that dads need support systems. And so I look at Adam Braverman from Parenthood because he had a lot that he was dealing
with. Okay, now you're just looking up TV dads. That's what you're doing right now.
No, Adam Braverman is like one of my, like, I like idolize him because he's got a kid that he's dealing with that has Asperger's. And how does he deal with that? Because he doesn't know anything about Asperger's. So he has to learn how to deal with that as he's actually parenting the kid. He's got his wife who's trying to like manage an election and become, you know, an elected official while she's pregnant. So, and then he's got to start up a new business with his brother. So he's got, you know, all these things that are happening to him. And he's like, and I have sisters I can go to. I have brothers I can go to. I have a dad that I could go to. So he's got a lot of good support system. So just the way Adam Braverman kind of navigated his life during the course of that show, I thought was really admirable as a, you know, kind of like the solid rock kind of dad.
I like that. I was also very partial to John Amos in Good Times. I thought he was a great dad. Loved him. I didn't like what they did to the character, but I still loved him. All right, so we got some listener thoughts, too, on this topic, like what makes a great TV dad. You guys ready?
Shoot.
Jennifer Miller, I love the perfectly imperfect dads. They make mistakes in front of their kids. They know when to hold firm on consequences and when you need to just move on from a mistake. A dad that leaves enough space for their kids to grow but has the guardrails firmly in place to keep them heading in the right direction. Right now, I am thinking of Dre Johnson from Black-ish. I never watched that show. Is that a good show? I haven't seen that one.
I've seen maybe an episode or two, maybe three, and yeah, it's not bad.
Chris Frid, best dad, oh boy. I think it's a parent who is there for their kids and wants them to be their best selves. Disciplines, but not with a heavy hand, with love. The examples, Ward Cleaver and Stephen Keaton. Oh, Family Ties.
Family Ties.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that is a very good one. Let's see. Josh Steinman, for me, one of the best dads who was routinely his own worst enemy was Tim Taylor from Home Improvement. So, totally aloof most of the time and addicted to danger, sketchy construction situations, but absolutely stepped up and got serious when his family, friends, or neighbors needed him. Excellent mix of buffoonery and genuine parenting. I always thought he was the closest we got to a live-action Homer Simpson. Humor and heart is what makes a good TV dad for me. Happy early Father's Day to all the pops out there, he says, which is very nice.
Was Tim Allen Phil Dunphy before Phil Dunphy?
No, he wasn't. No, Phil Dunphy is, I will literally die on this rock. I've rewatched that show a couple times now, and two things. One, Modern Family might be one of the most perfect comedies I've seen, because I don't think there's a season with a bad season. And almost every comedy I know that's gone that long has had a bad season. And two, he is consistently a good father, like throughout that show, no matter what he's doing, he is a good father and he's always trying to do the right thing for his family. Like he is never selfish. He never comes across as ridiculous. The only time that even comes close to crossing the line is the Godfather episode, but by God, that's worth it because it's one of the funniest things I've seen in TV. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google Modern Family Godfather and you'll see the way that they pay homage to that. But he's
there's a great episode that shows up on reels sometimes about this whole line and bit in the episode where it's his birthday and it's absolutely his birthday. It's supposed to be his day, but like everyone shows up and is actively ruining his day for him and they're not even thinking about it.
And he still ends up making it about them. That's just what he does.
Yeah, he does. He does. Like, you know, he still ends up making it about them, taking care of everybody else. He still does the thing. Under his breath, he's like, yep, this is my birthday. This is, you know, but at the same time, he still does the right thing.
And I will tell you this. Here's my going away. Number one trait that every good TV dad and father and parent in general is selfishness. They need to have that characteristic or you are not a good parent. If you constantly put yourself before your kids, you're not a good parent. I'm just letting you know. If you're wondering if you're a good parent, think of that, because that's the trick. You always have to think of them and what's best for them, not what's best for you. Because if it's what's best for you, you'll always pick the wrong thing. There, happy Father's Day to all the parents out there. All right, now we're going to spin it into our whole game. Let's make the worst parents. So here you get to pick the TV mom and dad from different shows, not in the same show, that would make the worst pairing for kids. Troy, give us your worst parents.
I mean, this one was easy for me, much like you mentioned, because he's a horrible dad. Tywin Lannister.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
Terrible. Such a bad dad. He actually died on Father's Day.
That's right. That episode did air on Father's Day, didn't it?
It sure did.
Oh, that's funny.
Tywin Lannister married to Irina Derevko.
Oh, Jesus. From Alias?
From Alias.
No, that's terrible. Oh, my God. But that would be an amazing show to watch. Those two? I would watch the hell out of that. I would watch them destroy those kids.
And then it's a comedy.
Just hijinks ensue. I would watch that. I think that sounds like a fun show. All right, John, can you top that one?
Lori Grimes and Tony Soprano.
Wow, that is good too.
Imagine growing up in that morally gray area.
You might have done it.
One parent cheats, the other one kills.
Kids messed up already. Mine is Moira from Schitt's Creek and Jay from Modern Family, just because I've been on a Modern Family kick, but I just think they would be terrible. But they wouldn't trump either one of yours.
That would actually be kind of still functional.
Jay might be able to be all right. I just think those two together would be the most toxic relationship of all time.
Yeah, I could see that. I guess he would be beating his head against a wall every 5 minutes because of her.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
He'd be like, there's a gun in the locker at the foot of the bed.
He just drank scotch till he died. All right, let's go to some upcoming attractions, Troy.
All right, June 20th, hidden theaters right out of the gate, 28 years later. It's interesting because The Rage Virus is now technically like a trilogy between 28 days, 28 weeks, and 28 years, which is the new installment. But 28 years itself is actually a planned trilogy as being the first movie of a potential three. So it's interesting how it's bridging the two gaps of those two places in this world. It's still going to focus on The Rage Virus overtaking civilization. Go check it out, because if you don't check it out, we won't get the additional two movies. And of course, one of our good friends of the podcast, at least mine and Aaron's, Alex Garland, is helping with this one. So it's gonna be good.
I don't know if I call him our friend, but
we like all of his stuff.
Yeah, we love all of his stuff. I think fans, maybe more fans.
super fans.
I'm just gonna show up at his house and see if he calls the police.
The second of the three has already been made. They're waiting to see if the first and second one, so 28 years and then the sequel do it. If the two of them make enough money, then they're going
to
do it.
This first one has to do well, or the third one will not happen.
Yeah.
Right.
So go see it. It's going to be great. Great cast. Elio is a boy that finds himself transported across the galaxy and mistaken for the intergalactic ambassador for our planet Earth. This is the Pixar insertion for the Father's Day weekend. Unfortunately, I have to go see Life of Chuck, and then I'm like gone. So I don't know if I'm going to get to see Elio to actually get it onto the podcast next week.
Aren't you mad? You are always making this a point that Pixar not releasing a movie on Father's Day weekend is a mistake. Is that not correct?
And it's going to be
coming
up
a week afterward.
Yeah, it's going to be a mistake.
Okay, I just want to see if that holds strong.
Kind of sad about it. Everything's going to be great. Maybe not for Pixar, but for this movie, there's no business like show business. For Buddy and Macy Smart, Bryan Cranston and Allison Janney, that means an unpredictable life working in regional theater while trying to raise their radically different sons, Lester and Derek. Through it all, Buddy pursues his unstoppable dreams, and Macy is left to pull it all together and keep the family afloat. As the family grapples with identity and belonging, they share a humorous and heartfelt journey of self-discovery, learning the power of owning your spotlight, no matter what stage of life you're currently in.
Sounds good. And speaking of theater, Troy, did you watch the Tonys last week? Did you see?
Hell yeah, I watched the 8 minutes of the Hamilton reunion.
The Hamilton reunion, the 10-minute? Oh my God, that was amazing.
So good.
Or however long, 10-year, not 10-minute, but it was about 5 minutes. It was a good, solid.
It was eight minutes long. And it's a 10-year reunion. The cast that I was all on Broadway originally got together, so did a medley during the show. I don't know why they made the women wear heels, because, man, it looked like they were going to fall over one or two times. But they made it work. Work, work.
It was great.
Work. Breitheart also is coming June 20th. Badass Secret Agent Sam has been tasked with one of her hardest missions yet, being a maid of honor for her childhood best friend. Rebel Wilson and Anna Camp star in that one.
Okay. Well, that's on that's in theaters. So streaming, we still got some streaming movies. K-pop Demon Hunters on Netflix. Can't wait. It's a musical action adventure that follows the story of a world-renowned K-pop girl group as they balance their lives in the spotlight with their secret identities as badass demon hunters set against the colorful backdrop of fashion, food, style, and the most popular music movement of this generation. And John's going to watch the hell out of it. I can feel it.
Would that be like if Josie and the Pussycats was like Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Kinda. Yeah. And had K-pop music.
Yeah.
Sure.
The K-pop sells it.
I'm sure it does for some. The Day the Earth Blew Up, a Looney Tunes movie, comes back to Max as Porky and Daffy are unlikely heroes and Earth's only hope when facing the threat of alien invasion. Just weird that that's coming back when they sold it, but whatever. The Waterfront, Netflix, 8-episode binge show. Melissa Benoist, who's Supergirl?
Correct. Supergirl, yep. Yeah. No?
Stars in this Kevin Williamson drama about a family's efforts to retain control of their crumbling fishing empire. Okay, so this is like Yellowstone, but instead of a ranch, it's going to be a fishing hatchery or something? I don't know.
It's Kevin Williamson, though. Is that like, I Know What You Did Last Summer?
No, he did Dawson's Creek, so he can do a mix, right? Yellowstone with axe murders? I don't know. I'd watch it.
Dawson's Creek with Scream?
I'd watch the shit out of that.
Yeah, that'd be more fun.
Noah's Ark, the movie. It's going to be on Paramount Plus with Showtime. Noah, who's played by Daryl Stevens and Wade by Jensen Atwood, are expecting twins and must shift gears when each is offered their dream job. And then we've got Barbara Walters, Tell Me Everything. It's a Hulu documentary on June 23rd. Offers an intimate look at Barbara Walters' life, career, and the challenges she faced as a woman in a male-dominated industry. And then lastly, Ironheart, Disney Plus, June 24th, set after the events of Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Ari Williams, who's played by Dominique Thorne, a young genius inventor, determined to make her work mark on the world, returns to her hometown of Chicago, and her unique take on building iron suits is brilliant, but in pursuit of her ambitions, she finds herself wrapped up when the mysterious yet charming Parker Robbins, a.k.a. The Hood, is played by Anthony Ramos. Speaking of Hamilton, he's great.
Mm-hmm.
Do we care about Disney Plus Marvel shows anymore? Where are we at?
Nope.
Yeah, they've kind of ruined it for us, haven't they?
Yeah, I think we talked about it a lot the last couple episodes. Yeah, I don't want to overdo it, but the answer is no.
Yeah, where it fits into the now hopefully revived, but not quite revived, New Avengers. I don't have any buy into this because I don't know how it fits into the grand scheme of things, the new scheme of things.
All right, now we switch to what you've been watching. John's got nothing new, but Troy, you've got Stick. What is Stick?
A show that I wasn't really going to give a chance to because I'm not usually in a comedy type of person, but this does fit into the comedy-drama-y aspect, like a Scrubs or a Psych would fit into. Mm-hmm. So I gave it a go. It's Owen Wilson in the lead. Speaking of Psych, Henry is in...
Corbin Burnson's in this?
Oh, no, Henry's not in the show. Henry's in a different show. I was watching both of them back to back, so I got my
What the hell, man? I got all excited for this stupid Stick. Now I don't want anything to do with it.
No, Corbin Burnson's in Duster.
Okay, well, we talked about Duster before.
Yeah, which is Owen Wilson, and Owen's going through a divorce. He was a golfer on the circuit, had a mental breakdown, basically lost everything, and now he has to get rid of the family home because the wife wants to move on, and she's dating somebody, and he basically finds a kid prodigy that he thinks he's going to coach and somehow makes magic happen and then goes on the road. And Marc Maron is in here as his like sidekick best friend. They hustle people at the bar to get money out of folks. And it's actually really great because there's a heartfelt moment at the end of the first episode that like, if that doesn't just get you in that moment, like you're not going to like the show. That moment at the end of the first episode is like the entire show of why what's happening is happening. But I watched the first three. All three were great. Laughed, cried. Definitely something to stick with for sure.
Okay. That's on Apple TV, right? The only streaming service you have.
It's the only one I pay for now.
I finished Mobland. I don't think I've talked about this, but if you haven't watched it, Tom Hardy, Pierce Brosnan, Helen Mirren. Tom Hardy's basically a fixer and it's on Paramount Plus. He's a fixer for the Harrigans, which are a mob organization, and they get into a war with the Stevensons, and there's a lot more to it. It's a lot more layered. I don't like mob shows. I do not. Typically, I don't care about The Sopranos. I don't care about anything like mob related, but I'm like, it's Tom Hardy. I'll give it a shot. And I only give it a shot because so many people were talking about it. It lives up to the hype. And a lot of that is because of Tom Hardy's performance. So usually in these shows, you know, you've got the muscle is always kicking everybody's ass left and right, right? Tom Hardy doesn't really do that. He's very much into soft intimidation throughout the show. So he'll walk into a room and he'll just imply that he will end you if he has to, but he'd prefer not to if you can work with him. And it just becomes this very, very tense series that goes over 10 episodes, ends on a strong point. They haven't renewed it yet, but I could see it going on or I could see it not going on. Either way, I think the whole season is really, really strong and very, very tense, which I totally recommend, even if I had to have subtitles on. The other one is Department Q. I watched that. It's on Netflix, 9 episodes. It's got Matthew Good, who you might remember from Watchmen, and he's a cop who basically survives a really terrible incident that leaves his partner paralyzed and another cop dead. And he's tasked with heading up a cold case unit, and he doesn't want to do it. He's kind of an arrogant prick. He knows more than everybody. He's the guy that should be doing, you know, the top-notch jobs, but he can't get his life together or his head right. And it's really just about him working with these guys, these kind of misfits in this unit, and trying to solve a case. It's a very serious yet also sarcastic show. I really, really liked it. And it's really interesting, and the mystery is strong. Like, it's a show, but I didn't really know much about it. I started watching, and I couldn't stop. So I definitely recommend that, too. Those are two shows where I had to have subtitles on for both of them the whole time. So there you go. There's my recommendations.
Can we do a what you shouldn't be watching ever?
Oh, God, I love that. Yeah. What?
Mountainhead. Mountainhead.
Fuck that show. I have no interest in that. That's the Succession guy, right?
It's not a show. It's a movie.
Yeah, it's from the Succession guy.
I watched 20 minutes.
No interest.
It was 20 minutes too long.
Yep.
It was terrible. It's literally tech dude bros talking tech dude talk. And it was like, I don't know what this movie's about. No idea what this movie's about. 20 minutes in, I'm out. It was so bad.
Don't need to watch rich assholes being assholes. Just don't need it.
So bad.
Good.
I don't know how it's a 79 on Rotten Tomatoes. I have no idea.
Because the Succession creators behind it. And the sad part is Steve Carell is fantastic. Like, he's actually a legit great actor. He really is.
And his character was the only reason I tried to stick with it as long as I could, because he has some kind of terminal illness and they're trying to like invent a cure for it because it's incurable. So obviously he's in it for the money to do the research and whatnot. So I was like, I was interested in that storyline because at least there was a thread, but that was the only thread.
They
wanted to get this one guy to get his AI thing in. And given the situation that's happening in Los Angeles right now, the fact that social media is like driving what's ever happening I did watch the first 20 minutes. There's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. It's just the acting's terrible. The writing's terrible. Like, there's good stuff in there. It's just they put it together in a really piss poor way.
And now I'm going to segue to my review of How to Train Your Dragon, because the live action remake of the animated original film is now in theaters. There is some debate about how shot for shot it is. I've talked to some people who are fans of the anime. I never saw the originals. Never saw them. I've heard that it's pretty close to shot for shot for a big portion of the movie, but there is like the 20 to 30 minutes of additional material that director Dean Dublois shot for this, so that there's something new for everybody. And I saw it in 3D, and I'll start there just to let you know. The 3D is solid, a little dark for my liking, but it's solid, so it's not a total waste like a lot of the 3D renderings these days. But okay, so this is written and directed by Dean Dublois, who also directed the animated trilogy, so he knows this franchise better than most. And it stars Mason Thames as Hiccup. He's also the kid from Black Phone. And it is Thames, not Thames, like some people want to tell you. Nico Parker is Astrid. Gerard Butler is Stoic, a.k.a. Hiccup's dad. Nick Frost is Gobber, the trainer of dragon killers. And it takes place on the island of Berk, which is inhabited by Vikings, man. You gotta love when there's Vikings, right? They're constantly in battle with dragons, which has gotta suck. It's like having box elder bugs, but, you know, dragons. So the chief of his clan is Stoic, and he's on a mission to make his son Hiccup a badass dragon hunter, as well as find the dragon nest and kill them all. Find all these bad boys and just end this nonsense. And you should keep in mind that Hiccup's mother was killed by a dragon. So there's a lot of anger and hatred and disdain going on in the family and the clan as well. So Hiccup is very creative, and he invents this weapon that shoots down the unknown Night Fury Dragon. No one's ever seen this one. It's not recorded in their Viking lore. I don't know how there's anybody left with all these dragons running around, but whatever, they're finding a way. But Hiccup cannot kill it. Just can't bring himself to do it. And as this little dragon, or not little, it's a big dragon, but as this dragon is injured, he helps nurse it to health, including creating a way to essentially ride it. You know, it's like a saddle with a mechanism to ride it or drive it. And the dragon is now named Toothless. So it's a pet. It becomes a pet and he trains it. I mean, it's in the title. Hiccup trains the dragon at night, and in the day joins forces with Astrid, who is this female dragon hunter who is badass. And of course, she's got a little crush on, and their friends, to train to kill dragons. But Hiccup is using this as an opportunity to find another way, because he believes there might be another way to coexist with these creatures that maybe they're not as bad as everybody thinks, despite the fact that dragons killed his mom and a bunch of his friends. He just has to convince everybody else of this. You know, can it happen? In an animated movie, it's a lot easier than it is in live action, let me tell you that. So right off the bat, the cast, I think, is very solid. Now, I have not seen the animated film. Don't love animated movies. So I don't have to sit there and go back and forth in comparison. It shouldn't matter. It doesn't matter to me. All I care about is this a good movie? Is this cast solid? And yeah, I think it is. I think Mason Thames is actually a very solid lead. He's very believable. He's a guy who at first wants to become this badass killer, but also has to basically grapple with the fact that his legacy is not really in that. Like, he is just not a killer. He is not his father, is really ultimately what he's trying to wrestle with, which is a common theme. And what a perfect time. Father's Day. We got a whole Father's Day theme episode. What a perfect time to see a movie like this, right? Then you have Nico Parker, and you may remember her. She played Sarah in The Last of Us, the daughter that didn't live. You know what I mean? So she does a very solid job here. You know, it's very much the stoic, tough love interest, if you will. And I do like what they do with that character, and I like the relationship, and it feels genuine. It really feels real, which I appreciate. Gerard Butler, by the way, he plays Stoic, again, Hiccup's dad, and he did the voice for the role in the animated film. I can only imagine how well he did there, because he's now age appropriate for this, and he fits it to a T. Like, he's perfectly cast in that respect. And then you've got Nick Frost as Gobber, the guy who's training the dragon wannabe killers, and I think he's just hilarious. And also very easily empathetic, too. He's easy to follow in line with and really understand where he's coming from, because he has a lot of really good advice and also missing a bunch of limbs. So he's got that going for him. Again, Gerard Butler plays the same role, and I definitely recommend that. The story, now I can compare it to some stills, because I did watch some of the clips of How to Train a Dragon after I saw this movie. And there are some scenes that are definitely shot for shot, right? So I can tell you, if you're a fan of the animated film, it's probably going to be basically the same movie for you. I didn't have that baggage, so I don't have to worry about it. But this is the only way I was probably going to watch it. And I'll tell you what, I'm glad they made a live action remake, because I really enjoyed the movie. I really did. So I'm glad that they had it. I do think a couple things are rushed in terms of the storytelling. You know, But overall, I really enjoyed the story. It's a story I didn't know and I wasn't aware of, so I didn't know any history of it. I just kind of came into it very cold. I mean, I knew the franchise existed. I knew basically what it was. It's just not a franchise I ever watched, you know? But really what makes it fly, if you will, are the special effects. There's something about dragons, right? Dragons, when they do the effects right, are just cool, man. There's just something about a badass dragon design. Now, one thing going into this, I'd seen the trailer a few times, and I realized that the dragon Toothless looks just like the one in the cartoon. I'm sorry, animated film. I don't want to offend anybody. It looks just like it, right? But I got to tell you, that was a downer for me, because I thought that the design looked silly in the trailer. Once I got to see the film in its full glory, and you actually get to see a dragon emote, and it really starts to feel like a little puppy, like the best, he's the best dragon boy, then it really starts to work on you. And then you get the other dragon designs and the other effects for them, and they become kind of relatable in many respects too. So they become almost pet-like. And it really comes close to that Rocket Raccoon vibe where you start seeing them as real as opposed to they're definitely fictional characters. And that's a plus. That's definitely a compliment to the film and to director Dean DeBlois. It's just something that I think really is important for a movie like this. And even though the designs are not like what I really love, like Game of Thrones has badass dragons, right? These are much more akin to the animated one, animated movie. So they're a little more family friendly. They're not meant to be terrifying, but there are a couple of really scary ones. The big overall queen, which I'm sure you've seen in trailers or if you've seen the animated film that you eventually get a little peek of, that definitely is a pretty terrifying design. And I really dig a lot of the designs that are here. And they're, like I said, a lot of the dialogue is taken straight from the original. A lot of the animation side-by-sides will compare. But overall, I'm glad that they made this movie for people like me that have never seen this franchise, that don't know anything about it. And I really like that the movie takes some chances. I do think some things are quick. There's one real story element that just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't care how fictional it is. And it revolves around how quickly we can get some dragons on our side as the movie rolls on. I think that is absurd, and it kind of really kind of dinged the story a little bit. It should have been done a little bit different. I don't know how, but definitely could have been done different. But love the relationship between Hiccup and Toothless. It really becomes a boy and his puppy, you know, is what it really, badass puppy. Puppy that can kill you, you know? And you know, I've had some friends with some pit bulls, you know, it's like that. So I like the relationship. I like the burgeoning relationship between him and Astrid. Love the relationship with him and his dad, because that's very relatable to, I think, most fathers, you know, where you want your not just your son, but your children to succeed, and you aspire for them to reach heights. And then they don't do the things you think they are capable of. You know, you can be disappointed, and it's not fair to the kid. You know, sometimes as parents, we need to listen more instead of putting our own projections on our kids and just learn who they are as people and try to accept who they are. And there's a lot of that kind of learning here. Now, some of it, that story aspect and the part I mentioned a minute ago, that's a little rushed. That kind of takes it down a little bit. But overall, this is it's a really good movie. It's a solid family film. I definitely recommend it. And the dragons are adorable. I do love a good dragon design, and I think they have some cool ones here. And also the scenes of flying and just flight through the air and kind of embracing the ability to ride the sky and how cool that would be, very much, you know, Lois Lane in the original Superman. I got that vibe, and I thought he captured that. Dean DeBlois captured that excellently. So if $10 is the full price of admission, I give How to Train Your Dragon $7. Definitely think it's going to be a bigger hit than most people think it will be, because I feel like this is the kind of movie that's going to play for a few weeks. All right, that's it for this podcast. I don't know. What are you guys going to do for Father's Day?
I'm going to a wedding.
Somebody's having a wedding on Father's Day?
No, it's on weekend? Saturday, so it's not on the Sunday, but yeah.
But it's Father's Day weekend.
Yep.
That's. Are they close? Are you close to them?
Cousins of the family.
Is there a chance they might listen to this podcast?
No.
Screw those guys. That's rude.
Also, the wedding's on. We're driving on Saturday to the wedding and then spending the night, right? And then driving back on Sunday.
Yeah, so on Father's Day. I get it. That's what I'm saying. Screw those guys.
In traffic with everybody else coming back into Chicago from Michigan.
I wouldn't go. I wouldn't go. I'd get them a toaster just to show them. What about you, John? Do anything?
No, I think How to Train Your Dragon's coming out this weekend. That's about the only thing I got interested.
You're going to go see your dad since you spent a year and a half with him?
I think not. No.
You're solid.
I think I've had enough time with my dad. No, I'm actually going to probably make plans to go see him for his birthday in August.
I hate that I probably have kids that feel the same way too. They're like, a couple days is good, Dad. We're good. They were just here for last weekend, unfortunately, for a funeral, but we still got to spend a lot of quality time. And I'm sure when they left, they're like, we're good for a while.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it kind of works, right? You know, you do that with your dad.
Yeah. No, I don't make it a couple days. No, it's usually about a couple hours. And Have I ever told you about the trip we took? Here, I'll leave you on this little tidbit. Here's a fun little insight into Aaron Peterson's relationship with Papa, who I love my dad very much. He's totally made up for, you know, the early stuff. So wonderful grandfather, best grandfather you can hope for. So we decided to take a father-son trip. Have I ever told you guys about my trip to Colorado? No?
No, I don't think you have.
Okay. We take a trip to Colorado. It's a road trip. Father-son bonding. We're going to this is 15, 20 years ago. It's been a long time. We're going to go see the mountains. We're going to go hang out in Colorado. We're going to go enjoy the wilderness and stuff. We had gone camping together, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, I'm an avid backpacker. I love the outdoors. Da, da, da. So we drive out there. We fight the whole time. The whole drive out there. From Illinois to Colorado is a nonstop fight. We get to Colorado. Get to a cool little mountain that you could climb it, or you could climb up it pretty easily, and they have a no trespassing sign. So my dad refused to go. So I, of course, went, because that's just me. And I wanted the view, and it was beautiful, and it was worth every ounce of quote-unquote illegal activity. Got back to the car, got in such a big fight, we turned around and drove all the way home. We were there one day. We were supposed to be there for an entire week. We made it one day. That's the last road trip we ever took together. Fun fact. And with that, that'll end the show. So take that advice, be a better parent than I was, and be a better son than I was. And remember, the next time you head to a theater, buy popcorn.